Yep. And continue on here. We're ready to resume with verse 4 of Ecclesiastes 1. The transience of man and the repetitive nature of the natural order. Verse 4, a generation goes and a generation comes. The word door here, D-O-R, first means literally a circle. Then it comes to mean a period of time, an age, a specific age. And very often the word is translated by the term generation, used of the time from birth till death. And then it's used of the time from the birth till death of one's offspring. Again, the younger generation being viewed as distinct. Deuteronomy 23:3 is one of the places it's used. And the younger generation, as it were, takes the place of the older generation. But again, here, Solomon, in a subtle way, I think, emphasizes the idea of death in that he's talking about the generation going first. Normally, I would think, as I was thinking through this, I thought, I normally would have said it just the opposite. The generation comes and the generation goes. Verse 3, no Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord, none of their descendants, even to the tenth generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. They were off limits permanently, as we see here. So a generation comes, and actually comes is the word, you actually have a calactive participle, halak, H-A-L-A-K. The word literally means walking, but the word walking in Hebrew does a lot of duty. It has the idea of coming, of going, of moving around from place to place. We know what walking is. And so the idea here is he personifies a generation as walking. Walking, departing here, as they say, and he's, as they translate it here, goes. A generation is walking away is the idea of kind of what he's saying, off into the sunset, we might say. And is a wow, that's supposed to be wow, not was, which is just the Hebrew connected copula that's used, it's a preposition actually, that's used in a lot of ways. The translation can vary all over the place because it is very flexible. And is fine here though, and a generation is door again, and then goes is bow. B-O, and then the Aleph is, we don't have a letter for that one. To come or to come in, and again, the idea here of the participle is he's showing this in perpetual motion. There's always a generation going, there's always a generation coming. Everything is always in motion. And that's one of the things he'll show here. For all the motion that we observe in the world, both at a human level and all the motion we observe in nature, what happens for it all? Nothing. But nothing. At the end of it all, you just got this repetitive motion. A generation goes, a generation is going, literally, and a generation is coming. But the earth remains forever. But, see, is here, now you got a wow. It's translated here in an adversative sense, because he is drawing a conclusion here that's adverse to what he's getting at. A wow plus a definite article plus the term eretz. E-R-E-T-S. The word is used in a number of ways, but in this book here, it denotes the planet, the dry land where mankind resides. And here it has the idea of the whole earth, the globe, we might say. But the earth remains forever. And then you've got a calactive participle here. It's a feminine singular because the feminine singular noun, eretz, it's modifying, of amad, A-M-A-D-H. Ahmad, again, it's a participle indicating standing, enduring, remaining. The earth remains forever. Prefix lamed to an age, literally. You got a prefix lamed here, which is just the L, plus the masculine singular noun of olam. O-L-A-M. This word means an age or a long age. It can refer to past time. It can refer to future time. It can refer to indefinite future time. It can mean forever. But understood here in a comparative sense with the generations coming and going. Did Solomon intend, this is where you have to get into the intent of the author. Did Solomon intend to tell you that he thinks the earth is permanent and eternal? That nothing's ever going to happen to it? And I don't think that's his theology here. I think he's comparing the earth and the fact that man is coming and going. The earth is the backdrop against which all this happens. And that it is the one constant in all of this, we might say. So I don't read into his theology here that he's trying to say, oh, I reject any future change in the earth and all that. He would have known about the flood. He would have known about catastrophes and all that. He would have known about the challenge to the earth in Genesis 1-2 there when it became without form and void. But from the human perspective, has the earth been here every day of your existence? Yeah. Will it be here after you're gone? Yep. I mean, given what we, absent any other revelation, the earth is the one constant in all of this. It never changes, as we might say. And he's going to show that it never changes. That the earth, the natural order, is just repetitive, and it's always there. I mean, when you got up this morning, you didn't get up to check to see, did the sun rise today? I mean, you knew it was up. You just take it for granted. So a generation goes, a generation is walking away, a generation is coming. But the earth remains forever. It's the constant. But even in this constant, what do we see in the constant of the earth? We see a bunch of repetitive actions that don't accomplish anything. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets. And hastening to its place, it rises there again. Also, is again a wow consecutive here. Now, the wow consecutive is technical Hebrew stuff, but... basically, when you have a wow consecutive, it changes the idea of the verb. If you have a wow consecutive with a cal perfect, it changes the force of it to an imperfect. They could have just written the imperfect, but they didn't. This is the way the Hebrew language functions. So the wow consecutive here, which is, again, just the prefix wow, but it changes the force of the verb. The cal perfect, third masculine singular here, zarah. Z-A-R-A-H. The word means to come out or to appear. And again, is Solomon writing in scientific language? No, but Solomon's a really wise guy. It's clear back even from the time of Isaiah that they recognized that the earth was round. He talks about the circle of the earth. That the earth wasn't flat. Now, they figured it out theoretically in 1492. That you couldn't sail off the edge of the planet. But the idea was ancient. The ancients knew this stuff. They weren't idiots. And so, is Solomon attempting to write here in scientific language? No. He's talking about the world the same way you and I would talk about it. We talk about the sun rising and the sunset. Did you see the sunset out at the beach? Well, do you think the sun really went down into the water? No. We don't think that. But we talk about it in these terms, very common terms. And so the technical wooden-headed literals will say, see, Solomon's an idiot. He thought the sun, you know, comes up in the morning and goes over here and then it goes down and, you know, it's got to rush around to get back to where it was. Well, he doesn't think that. The sun rises. Literally here you got, again, the imperfect changes the idea of here as repetitive action. The sun is the word Shemesh. S-H-E-M-E-S-H. And wow consecutive here, plus the cal perfect of bo, again, to go away. The sun appears and the sun goes away. Well, we just use the language rising and setting, because that's the way the human race sees it. The sun is, again, the definite article plus the common singular noun of Shemesh. And hastening to its place, it rises there again. You got a wow here plus the preposition el, E-L, which means to or toward. To its place is the masculine singular noun construct plus a third masculine singular suffix. To its place is makom, M-A-Q-O-M. Place, station, or destination. And to its place, the sun's, i.e., you got a cal perfect here. It rises there again. To its place, hastening is the word we're actually looking at here, is Sha'af. S-H apostrophe, that's the Aleph, A-P-H. Sha'af, 14 times, the word means to gasp or pant from fatigue. So the sun is viewed as wearing itself out in its process, as he personifies it here. In this repetitious cycle, the sun goes down, but it's got to rush around to get right back to where it was so it can rise again the next day. And the sun's working itself to death, we might say, as he personifies it here. And hurrying to its place, calactic participle, rising it there. Literally, is what you have in the Hebrew. You got zarah plus the pronoun, third masculine, singular of who. Who is he in the Hebrew, H-U. And it's referring back to the sun. It rises there again. And the adverb sham means there. It appears again. Blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north. The wind continues swirling along. And on its circular course, the wind returns. Blowing is actually, again, you see here the Hebrew term halak. H-A-L-A-K, walking, literally. But again, it's a participle, so it's indicating ongoing action. They translate it here, blowing, because he's referencing the wind. Now, the interesting thing here in this verse is he doesn't mention the wind until way down at the end. He doesn't tell you what he's talking about. He uses all these participles to describe it. Blowing to the south, preposition L plus the word darom. D-A-R-O-M, that word means south. And, wow, here, connective, and turning around, sabah, S-A-B-H-A-B-H, to turn or to go around, to the north, preposition L here plus the word saphon, which means north, T-S-A-P-H-O-N. Then you've got another calactic participle. He still hasn't introduced the subject, if you notice here. He's talking about the wind, but he hasn't told you what he's talking about. The wind continues swirling along. You've got the calactic participle, which is repeated. Turning and turning, literally. Sav-av. You got it twice. Walking. Again, calactic participle. All these are participles, which is designed to indicate ongoing action that just doesn't cease. It's just always happening. They translated here the swirling along, walking, and then you finally get the noun here, the subject of all of this. You got the definite article plus the common singular noun of ruach. R-U-A-C-H. That word means breath, wind, or spirit. Context has to determine how you're going to translate it. And some contexts aren't easy to figure out. But in this case, it's not that hard because he's talking about the natural order, and wind would be the most natural translation here. So blowing towards the south, turning towards the north, the wind swirls along. And on its circular course, the wind returns. And is wow, and then you've got a preposition here, ale, or al actually, on or upon. It's actually apostrophe al. Again, there's two Hebrew radicals that we really can't translate by an English letter, and so they're always representative. They're represented as an apostrophe, and that is Aleph, which is this one, and Ayin, which is this one. Ayin is kind of a guttural. They both have a kind of a guttural sound. There's no easy English way to reproduce them. There's certainly not a letter for them. But, you know, if you ever hear Jewish people talk, you'll hear certain words, or even Semitic peoples, and they'll have sort of a guttural sound to them. And that's about the best you can do with it. And that's what Ayin is. It's a guttural. So, again, on or upon, and then you've got an adverb here, plus the third masculine singular suffix to refer back to the wind. You have saviv, which is a cognate off of the noun, S-A-B-H, I-Y-V-H, Saviv. And here it means a circuit or a circular course. So the wind's always turning around. It's always blowing out there. I mean, even in Florida, you get some wind, not as bad as other places. But the wind's a constant on all this stage. We see, you know, winds are not unusual. We understand them. And then you've got a calactic participle of shuv, which means to turn or to return, and then returns the wind. Again, all of this, they translated it here, the wind returns, but again, it's a participle, so the idea is constantly returning. The wind's constantly blowing around. It's constantly going from the south, constantly going to the north. Then it blows around again, and it changes directions, and the wind's always out there blowing. Now, we don't know what direction it's going to come from, but we know that the wind is a constant. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Well, this is odd. You'd think the sea would fill up, but it doesn't. All is a masculine singular noun construct of coal, all. The rivers here is actually the term for a wadi. It's not the term for a river. Nachal, N-A-C-H-A-L. This means a valley or a stream. And a wadi was something, if you're familiar with the Middle East, these are dry a lot of the year. But at certain times during the rainy season, these fill up and then they run off. Then they eventually go back to dry. The water eventually flows out of them, we might say. And where does it go? Well, the rivers flow to the sea. And here you have cal, again, the cal active participle of walking, the same verb, halak. Again, we see how much duty this term can actually use, because he's talking about the rivers are walking into the sea. Well, we wouldn't translate it walking. We would translate, we understand water flows. So again, you've got a participle here, constant. These are constants. It's always happening. Rivers are always flowing into the sea. Flowing to the sea is a preposition L plus the word yam, which is sea. Then you have a wow adversative yet here. Translated, it's just a wow, but yet, he's drawing a conclusion, the sea is not full. A definite article plus yam again. And then you've got this adverb of existence. And an adverb of non-existence in this case, it's ayin. A-Y-I-N. A literal translation of this adverb would be, it does not exist. And yet, it does not exist a filling up. The sea doesn't get full. I mean, for smooth English translation, we would say, and the sea is not full. There does not exist, you got the adjective of male. M-A-L-E, olive. Filled up or full. And yet it does not exist a fullness. The sea doesn't get full. The water keeps flowing into it. Logic would tell you, well, God, shouldn't the sea get full at some time? It couldn't hold any more water. It doesn't work that way. Now, Solomon, what he's not doing here is he's not going to spend time trying to explain to you the hydrologic cycle. He's not going to explain to you about evaporation and perspiration and all the things that happen from our water that makes its cycle. But we know there is a hydrologic cycle. The water works a certain way. But Solomon just points out, hey, from a human perspective, you watch these rivers, they flow down. The Mississippi flows into the Gulf, and yet the Gulf level never changes. And yet water is constantly flowing into it, and it doesn't change. We better be very scared about global warming, though, because it could rise and we'd be underwater. No, I'm kidding, of course. So there does not exist, the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. To the place is a preposition L plus, again, the word literally masculine singular noun construct. That should be a singular, it's not a plural, I'm sorry. It's to the place where. Which is the relative, again, you've got a prefix sheen here, which is just an SH affixed to the word, which the rivers, again, Nachal, the wadi, to the place where the wadis flow, again, a cal active participle of halak, flowing or walking, in that place, adverb sham, they is the pronoun, third masculine plural of him. That's how it looks in the Hebrew, H-E-M. They turn or return. There they flow again is the way they've translated it. They turn to walk, literally. You've got a cal active participle of shuv, S-H-U-B-H. And then you have a prefix lamed plus the cal infinitive construct of to walk, literally, or to flow. So they flow into that place. And to the place where the rivers flow, they flow again. As these wadis fill up, they drain out into the sea. They all eventually run into the sea. And guess what? They fill up again, and they flow out into the sea again. And it's another example of the endlessly repetitive cycles of nature. He cites, as we will see here, the sun, the highest thing we might say that we can observe. Then he cites the wind, which occurs, of course, above ground. Then he cites ground level, the wadis, the rivers, the waters. And as he points out in all of this, the earth never changes. Yet for all of this activity, and again, all through here, and it's important to recognize that the vast majority of these things are participles, ongoing action. This is always happening. The sun's always rising and setting. The waters are always flowing. The winds are always blowing. And yet, what changes? Nothing. Not a thing. Well, point one, Solomon opens this section of thought with a statement about the continual procession of humanity that appears throughout time. People who live and die against the backdrop of an apparently eternal creation. And his point isn't so much, he's not making a theological point here that he believes that the world is eternal. What he is saying is it's the one constant we all can see and we all are familiar with. The earth was here when you got here. It's going to be here when you're gone. Again, absent any further revelation or any changes with the rapture, the earth will outlive you. The earth is still flowing. And the irony is, has anything changed since Solomon wrote this circa 930 BC? After 3,000 years, has anything substantial changed here? No. Any person in any generation could see these same things if they looked. Well, two, the obvious fact here is that Solomon deals with life in the opposite order that it occurs. He emphasizes death by placing it first in the progression, which actually gives us a hint as to why nothing is profitable for man. Back to the question of the previous verse. What profit is in there in which a man does? A generation goes, you're going to die. What profit is it? You're going to die. So he sort of hints at what he's getting at. Without coming out and saying, he will say it explicitly as we get into chapter 2. So he gives us a hint as to why nothing is profitable for man. 3, Solomon observes that nothing much changes from generation to generation, except the calendar. You get a different calendar every year, don't you? That's about it. What really changes? Nothing. In spite of all the apparent activity during any given generation, time simply marches forward. 4, the point here is that every generation of mankind is transient. One generation is replaced by the next as the previous generation inexorably dies. And this hasn't changed. Again, 3,000 years of human history. Has anything changed? Nope. Still the same old, same old. Generation comes, a generation goes. 5, people live and people die. As Solomon will later note, the generations do not seem to have a great deal of regard for those that came before them. So do you think people, say the younger generation, Gen X or whatever you want to call them, do you think they look at my generation and they say, hey, man, those guys are really great. I really have respect for all that they did. They are something, you know, we really spend a lot of time thinking about. No, not at all. They're not interested. They're self-absorbed. That's another whole thing about every generation. Every generation is self-absorbed, is it not? It's occupied with itself. Do you spend a lot of time thinking about the generation that existed before you, other than when you have to see your parents or something? You know, you have to deal with some older person. Do you really spend much time thinking about it? Most people don't. Do you spend much time thinking about the generation that's going to come? Unless you're involved with it in some way, probably not. You know? So the generations, as we're going to see, are self-absorbed. They don't think about stuff very much. And they don't think about what's happened before. And they don't think about what's going to happen next. They're just consumed with living in the moment. Well, 6, neither will those that come have any apparent regard for the current generation. Ecclesiastes 1:11. There is no remembrance of earlier things. Why? Because people can't remember them? No, because they choose not to think about them. It's not that memory doesn't work. And also of the later things which will occur, there will be no remembrance of them among those who come later still. Fact is, it just doesn't change. Ecclesiastes 2:16. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool. I mean, unless you're, you know, infamous in some way. People remember Hitler, don't they? You know, nobody names their kid Adolf Hitler anymore. I wonder why. People don't name their kids Judas. You have to be infamous to be remembered. And it's not the good people that are remembered. I mean, some people do remember good people. I mean, you know. People remember people that made great advances, you know, maybe in terms of your research or something. People tend to know who Einstein was. But who was Einstein's best friend? Well, his name was Sherman. Who knows that? See? I don't know what his name was. I've seen a bluff. I don't know what his name was, but Einstein probably had a best friend, didn't he? You figure. Well, who knows who he is? Nobody. But we remember Einstein. And the fact is, you have to be, again, in some ways infamous, or people just forget you. I'm sure, you know, when I die, you know, if my obituary is in the paper, it probably will, I hope it would be, you know. You know, say something nice about him. He was a great guy. Didn't have an STA. You know, that kind of thing. But after they read the obituary that day, are they going to remember me and say, oh, yeah, Ron, he was something? No. You know. Like in that movie, The Lord of the Rings. Do you think they'll ever write a book about us? Probably not. Well, as it turned out, they did. Well, the idea here is that people don't think about that stuff. So verse 16 here, for there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man is with the fool. Inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten. People have, okay, this is what else do we know about the human race? Short memory. Who won the Super Bowl this year? Who won the national championship in college basketball? Who's going to win the tournament players championship today? It won't be Tiger Woods. But, and again, who won last year? Who knows? Who won the World Series? People have, they forget. And there's no lasting remembrance of things. Mankind is very transient, and they're very self-absorbed, and they don't tend to think about very much. Certainly not the past or the future that much. Also, chapter 9, verse 5 here. For the living know that they will die. The dead do not know anything, for they have no longer a reward, for their memory is forgotten. Now, again, do we have greater revelation that tells us more about death than what Solomon's stating here? Yes, but Solomon's talking about life as we see it under the sun. When people die, how quickly are they forgotten? Just like that. They're dead. They're gone. And you know what happened? Like, say, an athlete dies or something? Or gets killed like this. There was this pitcher here not too long ago. I think he played for the Cardinals, if I remember right. Got killed in a drunk driving accident. He was drunk, died. They wear his number on their sleeve for one game. You know, all of them go out and they put, you know, they wear Virginia Tech deals to, you know, to celebrate the massacre at Vicksburg. And but then they forgot about it. You know, who stops and thinks today about Columbine? No, well, there's a new massacre that we got to think about. There's a new nutcase with a gun. And so people forget about this stuff. It comes and it goes. And fame, that's another whole issue he's going to get at, is look at Solomon. Don't you think he was famous in his day? He was. He absolutely was the talk of the world. He was the Israeli idol. Everybody knew about him. To the ends of the earth they knew about him. Did that make him happy? And how fast did they forget him when he died? Oh, he heard about Solomon. Who? And yet, I mean, again, he's infamous because of his wisdom here, and he's recorded in the Bible, his writings. But other than that, would you know who Solomon was? Even if he was the greatest mind of his time? No. Not if it wasn't recorded in the Bible, we wouldn't. So again, the people don't have any regard for this. It comes and it goes, and it comes and it goes quick, and then people don't worry about it. They're thinking about other things. Well, 7, however, as Solomon makes clear here, each self-absorbed generation will have its day in the sun and will be replaced by another self-absorbed generation. It's going to happen. 8, the backdrop for this continual cycle of human beings is the earth itself, which is viewed as being the constant in the equation of human existence. Psalm 104:5. And again, Solomon's not making a theological point here that, oh, I believe the earth is eternal. He's just saying, from the perspective of human existence, the one constant we have in this equation is the earth. And yet, as we will see, the earth itself is in this continual progression of cycles that doesn't change. Psalm 104:5, he established the earth upon its foundations, so that it will not totter forever and ever. And again, depending upon your perspective, or do people want to read into this theology, oh, David thought the earth was eternal? He probably knows it isn't. Certainly some of the later prophets allude to the fact, what does Isaiah say? The earth totters to and fro like a drunkard. He didn't think the earth was all that stable under one of the prophecies. The earth wasn't viewed as being stable at all. Also, Psalm 119:90. Your faithfulness continues throughout all generations. You establish the earth and it stands. They stand this day according to your ordinances. For all things are your servants. And of course, Solomon would have been aware of these Psalms. This would have been a part of his Bible. And the point is, while Solomon doesn't say it, he would recognize that God created the earth. This natural order that we see out there is God's handiwork. But he's going to also use it to prove his point that its life is endlessly repetitious. Can you say endlessly repetitious 100 times? Because that gives you the idea of what he's getting at here. Endlessly repetitious, endlessly repetitious. And nothing changes. So 9, as several interpreters have noted, Solomon is not stating a belief that the earth itself is eternal, but that it is the one apparently permanent item on which the progression of generations is played out. 10, while interpreters have debated the exact manner in which we are to understand the term la'olam, which is the prefix lamed there with the term forever, it is used of both the past, say Deuteronomy 32:7, an indefinite past at that, and Job 22:15. So Deuteronomy 32:7. Remember the days of old. Again, the days of old would be the past. That's our term. Consider the years of all generations. Ask your father and he will inform you. Your elders and they will tell you. Just give an old person a chance to talk. Hey, what would you like to say? Well, they got stories. And they can regale you with tales from long ago. And some of which may be true, some of which may be embellished. That's another whole thing you got to think about when you're listening. Also here, Job 22:15, used a past time. Literally, will you keep to the path of old? The ancient path is the way they've translated here. Will you keep to the ancient path which wicked men have trod, who were snatched away before their time, whose foundations were washed away by the river? And then it's also used of future time, for instance, in Psalm 9:7. And that's the idea here. Our idea is, it kind of looks at both the past and the future in one sense. The earth stands forever. I mean, it's always been here, as it were, and it's always going to be here. Psalm 9:7. So again, the idea I want to stress is that Solomon is not trying to say that I permanently believe that the earth is eternal and will never, ever change. But for the sake of what he's talking about here, it is the constant. But the Lord abides forever. That has the idea of future, into the future, into the indefinite future. He has established his throne for judgment. So 11, it also is used to refer to the fact that the future is indefinite and may simply have the sense of for the rest of your life even. So the term shouldn't always be translated forever in that sense, because Deuteronomy 23:6 is a place it's used. And he's not talking about forever at that level. Deuteronomy 23:6, you shall never seek their peace or prosperity all your days. There they've translated it, all your days, has the idea of while you are alive. So again, the idea is that the future is indefinite. We don't know how long it is. But as from a human perspective, just simply looking at this, under the sun, the earth appears to be the one constant that we can look at and say, yeah, it's always been here, and as far as we know, it always will be. Psalm 5:2 also is a place where this is used. Pardon me, Psalm 5:12. That doesn't look like the right verse. I don't know what I was looking for there. That scratched the psalm verse. That's not correct. Longman here probably best explains its usage here as he states that here, forever refers to the future as far as the mind can conceive. As far as we know, from a strictly human perspective under the sun, the earth is a constant. It's not going to change. It's always been here. It'll always be here. 13, therefore, one should not believe Solomon is arguing here for some theological position that the material universe will last forever in an absolute sense. This term is not always used in our modern sense of endless time. The usages there should kind of demonstrate that, that the usage can be general. And you actually could say, you know, the earth, the generation comes and the generation goes, but the earth remains all your days. I mean, as far as you know, the earth's going to be here. 14, what he is saying is that from the perspective of every generation that has been on the earth, the world has and will outlive those who have been given authority over the earth. And that's kind of the irony is here that, you know, in Genesis, if you know, as you probably know, man was given authority over the creation, yet the creation's going to outlive him. And so that's where we got into the idea of stewardship. If this is given to you and you're a steward of it, the earth is going to outlive you. So you better think about how you use it. So 15, in support of the contention that the earth is the only permanent feature in the generations of humanity, Solomon now appeals to the relentless cycles of nature that are observable by any generation. And there's nothing he says here that you and I can't go outside and say, yep, that's right. It hasn't changed materially in 3,000 years. 16, he observes the continual and observable cycles of the sun, the wind, and the water. 17, Solomon indicates that the very cycles of nature demonstrate the seemingly endless repetitious nature of life under the sun, which sees a lot of activity that accomplishes nothing in the end. And the idea here is, for all man's work, for all that he's done, what was the greatest dynasty in Egypt? Probably the 18th was one of them. The 12th was also another. But for all their greatness, what's left? What did they accomplish? Can you name me any of the kings of the 12th dynasty of Egypt? Probably not. So the idea is that for all man's activity, for all he's done, what has he actually accomplished? What's changed? Really, realistically. Now, we have greater technology. But we can travel from place to place, say, in an airplane now. But isn't travel, the fundamental concept of travel, just going from one place to another? And man from the earliest ages tried to make travel as fast as he could. I mean, so we harnessed horses, and then we developed chariots, and then wagons, and then automobiles. But are these really fundamentally different? No, they're just advances in technology. But it's still the same old principle of I'm moving from point A to point B. How I get there is really irrelevant, isn't it? That's the whole concept of travel. Let's go to point A to point B. So again, all this activity, what does it accomplish? All the airline flights going off today, what are they going to do? They're going to fly them again tomorrow. And people will be moving around from place to place. But what really changes? Nothing. You go to an airport, aren't they all about the same? I mean, some are bigger, some are smaller, but aren't they all about the same? Don't they have the same things going on? Pretty much. So all this activity, what does it ultimately accomplish? All the business it's done, what's changed? 18, one should not assume that Solomon did not recognize that what his father had written was true. However, he is expressing another seemingly valid point of view. For instance, Psalm 19, and Solomon would have been familiar with this psalm, no doubt. And the reality is that both these things are true. Psalm 19 is true, and what Solomon writes here is true. They both express different viewpoints, but they're both equally true. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. I mean, when you look at the endless reaches, or apparently from our perspective, endless reaches of space, what does it say? It says God is very, very big. Space is very, very big. And you look at all the endless, you know, things out there, planets, stars, all this, galaxies. And what does it say? God's also very creative. He created a lot of stuff. He didn't just make a void, he filled it up at some level. And so Psalm 19, day to day pours forth speech. Night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard, but their line has gone out through all the earth, and their utterances to the end of the world. In them he has placed a tent for the sun, which is a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. It rejoices as a strong man to run its course. Its rising is from one end of the heavens, and its circuit is to the other end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. And that may even be some of Solomon's back in his thinking. Is, does the material universe show the glory of God? Yes, it does. It shows his creative ability. It shows his wisdom. It shows all kinds of things about God. It shows his power. And as we see, the same argument is advanced in Romans 1. That the people could see there was a God. They just rejected his existence or rejected him. So is this a valid view that the world out there, we can look at it and we can see certain things about God? Yes. But is the world also an endlessly repetitive place in which nothing much is accomplished or changed? Yes. Both are true. So 19, human beings, like the ceaseless cycles of nature, come and go without materially changing the earth. And you'll come and you'll go, and guess what? The world will pretty much be the same, won't it? Have you materially changed this world? Have I materially changed this world? No. The cycles of nature still go. 20, this is emphasized by the repetition of the particle bow. A participle, bow, goes. And again, all these participles indicate ongoing, relentless action, which creates a comparison between the relative futility of all human endeavor and the relative futility of the action of the sun. 21, Solomon does not attempt to use scientific language again as he describes the cycles of nature. He speaks as any man would when he describes the rising and the setting of the sun. For those who like to argue, oh, this isn't scientific, so it can't be accurate. Oh, come on. Give me a break. You know, we know the sun doesn't rise. The earth rotates around the sun and it spins on its axis. You know, okay, all right, we all understand it. But we don't talk like that in our normal lives, do we? Well, the sun gravitated around the earth, and so it appears that the sun came up. But in fact, the sun didn't move. We moved. Okay, great. Now you're more technically accurate. So what? The sun rises and sets. 21, he doesn't attempt to use, again, scientific language. He speaks as any man would. 22, from an earthly, purely earthly perspective. The sun moves upward in the sky from the east, traverses the heavens, and sets below the skyline in the west. 23, this cycle has been endlessly repeated throughout the generations of human history. There is not a generation that has not made note of this sequence of events. You figure it out pretty early on when you're a human. It doesn't take you forever to figure out the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. And, you know, hopefully they teach you that early or you figure it out on your own. So it's endlessly repeated. And is the sun still rising in the east and setting in the west today? Yep. Hasn't changed. 24, he closes verse 5 with the idea that the sun must seemingly scurry around the planet in order to arrive at the same point in the east, so it can simply repeat its route through the heavens. 25, the Hebrew verb sha'af here, hastening, personifies the sun, panting with fatigue as it rushes to its destination. And 26, like the sun, the human race seemingly never changes anything. All people get for their toil is to wear themselves out. You know what's going to happen to you, don't you? You're going to get older, you're going to run down, you're going to wear out, you're going to die. That's what's going to happen. So, again, the thinking person will have to say, well, what? Why is he saying all this? Why is this apparently depressing viewpoint here? Well, why is he pointing this out to me? What is Solomon getting at? And again, recognizing he's writing to a younger generation, he wants them to see the futility of things. That things are, at a certain level, futile. And earth, the nature demonstrates this, that they're futile. The sun is futile in its endeavors. It never really changes anything. It never accomplishes anything. That's just the way it is. So he wants you to see the same thing about the human race. Does the human race materially change things for all of their actions? No. Things will be the same tomorrow pretty much as they were today. So 27, Solomon now moves to the cycles of the wind. Which seem to provide the appearance of change, but which are ultimately just repetitions within an ongoing pattern. 28, Solomon does not immediately identify the subject in verse 6, as he uses five participles to describe the idea of a lot of action. I mean, if you read it in the Hebrew, you just get this five participles of ongoing action, 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 action. Okay, it's happening, it's turning, it's blowing, it's on and on and on. And then he introduces, oh, I'm talking about the wind, by the way. Lots of action. But for all the actions of the wind, has the world changed? No. And the wind blows, and it blows, and it blows, and it blows, and it blows. It blows more in some places than it blows in others. The wind comes sweeping down the plain, but yet the plain's still there, isn't it? Nothing's changed. It blows out of the south, it blows out of the north. And that's his whole idea here, is that there's a lot of action, a lot of activity, but what's really changed? Nothing's really changed. 29, these five participles indicate that the wind is in perpetual motion, toward the north, toward the south, and turning around again and again. However, all this action provides little consequence. I mean, unless you're in a hurricane or something, tornado, well, then you might have a little more respect for the wind. But the idea here is, in normal everyday life, we're not in tornadoes or hurricanes, in normal everyday life, the breezes blow, they blow, they blow, they blow, they blow. So what? What happens? What changes? Nothing. All right, well, time's up. We will stop there and continue on here on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us, in Christ's name. Amen.